to let Steve keep from talking to me. I listened to your configuring Fluxbox for work on the Bad Apples recently. As you know, but maybe your listeners don't, I've been running a mixed series of apps on a small window manager for years now. And I just wanted to share with your listeners, through you, some tips that I found that were important. I started out with running exclusively KDE and desktop, and the window manager for KDE is KWin. And then I began moving to my own, for the sake of customization and lightweightness, my own favorite window manager, SWM, as well as replacing apps here and there from the KDE suite with some smaller apps that were faster and that I enjoyed more, however, were written on the GTK desktop. So your GTK theme recommendation works like a charm. I really, really, that really has enhanced the slickness of my email, my iceweasel applications, as well as it actually also modifies to match the Rocks Filer file manager, which I use. Now, the GTK apps, interestingly enough, to really get full customization, I found that it was important to load something called the GNOME settings daemon and kick that off in your starb scripts. And some of the settings do just work off of the .gtkrc file in your home directory, which is what the GTK theme program actually modifies. And some other settings need this living daemon that uses resources in the background that I really don't like. So that was an important, so I thought I would give you guys that tip, and I would bet you dimes to donuts, even though I haven't tested it, that to get the best mileage out of the GTK QT engine, you know, the little component you can add so that your GTK applications take their cues from the KDE configuration dialogues, would probably work optimally with that install. The other thing I thought I would mention, since some people may be looking to like run in light, is that when running KDE apps on a window manager, you can actually insert a command into your startup scripts called start KDE, and what this will do is preload all the libraries that the majority of KDE applications are looking to. When you use something like Conqueror, Conqueror quickly loads the libraries it needs anyway. KMail takes much more time. KMail was really annoying without running start KDE first, and I was running it from the .x session or the .x init scripts, but now I use IceWM's version of it. I hope this feedback helps out all your listeners who may be following in footsteps, and since you and I, our footsteps can be similar sometimes, I thought I would give this to you as audio so you could just plan your show, and hope that helps you out, it helps everyone out. See you around. Bye-bye.
So what you just heard was Deep Geek, audio comment from Deep Geek, talking a little bit about, or rather in reference to the episode that I did, not just this last release, but the release before that, where I was talking about customizing Fluxbox, and he's giving some tips, that was very good, thanks a lot, Deep Geek. And, well, I guess obligatorily I should say, you know, if you're not listening to his show, you should, it's a good show. And then, to sort of expound upon what he's saying, is that I've actually kind of been meaning for a while now to maybe do an install of GNU Linux on just a stripped down version of it on some device, whether it's my triple EPC or another laptop or something, and just not even bother installing GNOME or KDE libraries, which, I mean, I've kind of done that before already, back when I had Debian back on my triple EPC. It was a good install, I really liked it, and it came about because the triple EPC had sort of gotten, it went missing, let's say, and it was out of my control. When I got it back, it wasn't really working the way that it was supposed to be working. I don't know how that happened, but it did happen. And so I was about to leave for Ohio Linux Fest the next morning, so that night I just frantically downloaded the minimal install of Debian and slapped it on there. Didn't even bother installing X, for instance. It was completely, you know, just, it was the bare minimum. And then I think at OLF, I think I went the whole festival without X, and then I think eventually, maybe like towards the end of the festival or maybe afterwards, I went ahead and installed X on there, and then I put Enlightenment on there, and and kind of built it up literally from there. The point being that that kind of minimal install is pretty basic. It's pretty hardcore and pretty simple, and it's a beautiful thing because you realize how much you can do without those big KDE and GNOME apps and stuff like that. So you know, you can do a lot just, well, first of all, you can do a lot with a command line, but if you need the graphics, a lot of times you can do a lot with just X apps and Enlightenment apps and, you know, things like that that don't really require the GNOME and KDE stuff. The web browser, as far as I know, gets a little bit tough because a lot of them seem to be based on, you know, the GTK toolkit or whatever. So at that point, I guess you kind of have to start installing more. I don't really remember what I did about that, but I think I did Firefox at the time, probably. So yeah, that starts to get a little bit beefier, but and there's probably something out there that I'm not thinking. I mean, Dillo, I don't know what that requires, but I do remember that that didn't quite fit the bill for what I needed to do. You know, I mean, like, a lot of times if I'm going to web browse, I can do it in Link, and the only step up from that, the only reason I would need to go up from that is because Lynx isn't working with some site. And usually if Lynx isn't working with it, then you need something really, really beefy like Firefox, because it's practically the same thing as installing Dillo or Aurora or Midori or something like that. The point is that it's too stripped down for these fancy, stupid sites that don't know how to be universal. So it kind of falls apart at that point. But you can get by without it, but without a browser or a GUI browser, then you might be good to go with a lot of different things. So this is episode 5 of season 5 of The Bad Apples. My name's Klaatu, and this is, I'm actually recording this just right after the release of the previous episode, so not a whole lot to catch up on per se, but one of the things I am doing is, well, I just got back from a Richard Stallman talk that he was giving at a local university here. It's a really good talk on copyrights and stuff like that. I already kind of got the tip off on this talk. This seems to be on his copyright tour, so to speak. I already kind of heard this talk on some interview that he did down in New Zealand when he was going to go talk to some librarians, I think. Monster B had posted that, I think, to the either privately to just the other Linux cranks or actually on the Hacker Public Radio feed. I don't really remember which one. I think he had to do it privately because the thing wasn't licensed to be redistributable. So, yeah, it was a really good talk, and I was going to try to get an interview with him, but after 120 minutes, I think, of talking for about, I want to say like 100, no, probably like 90 minutes, and then the rest of it was question and answer. So I figured he was probably, I mean, you know, tired, and probably speaking to him at that moment probably wouldn't have been the best moment. So plus he was being swamped by other people who wanted to talk to him or get his autograph or whatever. I didn't really care for his autograph, but I would have interviewed him if I'd gotten the chance, but maybe later. So that was a good talk and a good experience. This is actually, I guess, my second time of seeing him. It was kind of cool to see that he actually is a really good talker and has a lot of great things to say. It's not just an act. He really does. He's an insightful kind of guy. Yeah, I mean, if you agree with him. If you don't, then he's bag of hot air, but I happen to agree with most of what he says. Okay, so this episode I wanted to talk about XML. RSS, actually, but more broadly XML, because to understand RSS, you kind of need to understand XML, and if you understand XML, then you not only understand RSS, but you start understanding a lot of other things, too. And the reason I'm talking about this is because a lot of people have been asking me about it lately, and because some of the jobs that I've had recently have actually been very, very involved with XML, so I'd like to just kind of let you know what I know and apply it to RSS feeds, which I obviously use often enough. So let's do that. And if you hear background noise, which you probably will, you're going to be hearing just passersby, because I'm just out sitting on a park bench near a, I'd say, 3-foot-high bank of snow. So just kind of chilling here, so sorry for the noise. So XML is an extensible markup language, right? So it's very similar to HTML. And so if you've ever used HTML, you've used a markup language, and you're probably familiar with some of the basic concepts. And one of those concepts, one of the big concepts, I guess, to just understand what markup language is that in HTML, if you want to make a word appear bold, you put tags around it, some bold tags. So in this case, it's bracket B, close bracket, and then the word, and then bracket slash B, close bracket. And that's the old style of doing it. Not really. That's kind of deprecated now. Well, it's not kind of. It is. It's deprecated now. But let's just use that as an example because it's an easy one. If you surround a word in those two tags, and you open up the document that appears in a, for instance, web browser or any application programmed to respect those tags, then you'll, rather than seeing bracket B, close bracket, word, bracket, slash B, close bracket, you'll actually see the word, but it will be in boldface type. So what you've got there is essentially your source code, which is written in HTML, and then you've got your interpreter, which would be, in this case, the web browser, that knows not to show the person the actual tags, but rather to do to the word surrounded by the tags what the author is telling it to do. Now, in HTML, you've got a set number of tags. You've kind of got certain tags that are defined for you, right? So if you suddenly decided that you wanted that word to be written in three-dimensional letters and spin around, you can't just put a tag around it that says 3D and spinning, foobar, and then close spinning, close 3D, right? You put that into a browser, and it's just not going to do anything with those tags. It, at best, it'll just leave that word as is. At worst, it will refuse to open the document at all. So in HTML, you've got a set number of tags, and those number, the tags that you can use and what they may contain and things like that are defined by, I think, W3C or something, or the HTML committee, I don't know, whoever decides what's going to go into HTML. Now in XML, interestingly, you can make your own tags. And HTML and XML both actually use this convention, which is the convention of having a schema, S-C-H-E-M-A, schema. Now, a schema is a document with, essentially, a list of possible tags within a document. So if you, for instance, are going to write something in DocBook, and DocBook is kind of a term that you might have heard if you've ever looked into like documentation or contributing to a documentation team or something like that. But a lot of people kind of think of it as a program or something, and it's not really. It's a set of schemas which you can use and then use a set of tools on, and they're all kind of aware of the same schema. So they kind of format the source code that you've used DocBook tags in a certain way. And so that's similar, again, to sort of HTML, or the modern implementation of HTML, which is more specifically called XHTML, because now there's an XML schema designed to look and act just like HTML, with some modifications, some CSS allowances made here and there. But the schema is essentially going to define what kind of document you actually have. So if you've got a DocBook schema, then you're writing using those tags, and when you give it to some other application, it is going to see the DocBook schema being declared, and it's going to treat that document according to the DocBook schema. And if it's an application designed to read the DocBook tags and interpret them in some way, then it's going to do that. I don't know of one off the top of my head, but I know that there are out there, and in fact I've mentioned one on, I think, Tit Radio before, where it was kind of what you see is what you get editor for DocBook stuff, so that you could put a DocBook source code in this file, and it would almost word processor-like show you exactly how it's going to end up. And this is possible for anything, and in fact you can make your own schema if you wanted. So if you have, if you've invented say a widget set, or a widget, whatever a widget is, right? So you invent a widget, and you look for a good schema to use, because you want to document these widgets. You want to catalog them and organize them and stuff like that, and label them and describe them. And so you look for a good schema that could help you to do this, and you don't find one that's really good. You find schemas for everything and other widgets, but there's just your widgets are so progressive and so unique, you can't find one that actually actively or accurately describes them. So you make your own schema. Believe it or not, you can do that. No, I don't know how, but you can. And it's a text file again, you know, and it's just, I mean, there's a certain format that you would use. And you can create your own schema, and eventually you're going to get to the point where you're describing your own tags. And so you say, okay, well, my widget needs a spectrum tag, widget spectrum, a widget frequency tag, and a widget brilliance tag. So these are really spectacular, kind of shiny, sparkly widgets. And those are the tags that you need. So you would define that in your schema, and then in your XML document that you're going to create, you will first cite, well, first you'll say that it's XML version 1. That's the first line of your XML document, and that's so that whatever kind of interpretive program you're throwing this at knows that it is an XML document. And then next you're going to have to tell it what schema it should use. And so in this case we would use the widget schema, or the widget ML schema, whatever. And then you can open up a widget tag, let's say. So you'd say, okay, open widget tag, and then you would put, okay, so this widget is, the widget brilliance tag is, let's say, 10, and then you'd close the widget brilliance tag. You'd say the widget spectrum is 5600, close widget spectrum, and the widget frequency is 96, and then you close the widget frequency. And then you would close the widget tag, so close widget. Now these tags as well, the widget tag, just plain widget, that would have been described in your schema. So, you know, everything you're using within your document is defined in your schema. So it's a bit, I think, like almost an include file on, you know, programming stuff, although I'm not too sure about that, so don't quote me. But that's what I imagine an include file would be like. So you've got the, or a header file, actually, probably would be more accurate. Either way, it's like that. So you've got one widget defined with your little spectrum and frequency and brilliance tags. So now we might invent a second widget that we want to, or a variation on that first one, and we want to catalog it. So you open up a new widget tag. So you bracket widget bracket, and then widget brilliance is, let's say this one goes all the way up to 11, and then so you close your widget brilliance, and then you open a widget spectrum tag. That's 6500, close widget spectrum, and then open widget frequency, and that goes up to 98, and then close widget frequency, and then close the widget tag. So now, you can almost picture it, right? You've got these two widgets, and you know that they're two widgets because they each have a open and a closed widget tag. So you've got two events, you know, two containers, I guess, as people say, with a different widget in each. And then you've got the details about that, the attributes describing those widgets contained within that opening and closing widget tag. And eventually you'd get to the bottom of your document where you've described all of the widgets that you've invented so far, you're happy, so then you close the XML document. And now you've got your own XML document defined by your own widget schema that accurately describes the things that you're trying to describe. And then you can write your own little application, maybe a widget viewer, or maybe a widget database, or maybe something that does both. Maybe it's a big database that also samples the widgets or something. Who knows? But the input files of these applications would be the widget XML that you've invented. And because it has access to that schema, it can interpret those tags and everything correctly. Now, the interesting thing about these applications that are going to interpret the XML is that you can kind of do whatever you want to, right? So first iteration of it, maybe it's just going to show the text under widget brilliance. It's going to be a 10 or an 11. And then there's going to be maybe the, just the text of the frequency. So the frequency is just 96 or 98. And then it's going to be just the text of the spectrum. That's a basic little database application. Not much to it, but we're proud of ourselves. For the second version, version 2.0, we decide that we want to reflect the actual measurement of the brilliance of the widget. So we tie it into some kind of graphic generator, whether it's like Image Magic or whether it would be something even fancier, like some kind of Qt pre-built graphic generator for yourself. The point is that you can use the value in the widget brilliance tags to talk to some other thing and to show the viewer something completely different, not just the text within it, but something that is measured off of the text. So there's, you know, there's a lot of possibilities here, and you see these kinds of things in all kinds of applications, really. And you can probably, if you look hard enough, you'll see all kinds of applications that do output or use as input an XML file. Some of the, I guess, really popular examples of this would be the podcatchers out there, or so they're called, the applications that are basically feed readers for RSS, and they're specifically geared for podcasting and internet radio and things like that. And they will take a simple RSS feed and they will translate it, just the text, into pretty graphics for you. So that, for instance, if I choose to put into my XML feed, my RSS feed, a link to a picture that exists somewhere out there on the internet, and someone subscribes to my feed, an application could choose to just ignore the image that I'm linking to within my XML file, or if they've made a fancier version, then they can show the image. They can actually say, okay, well, rather than just showing the person either nothing or showing the person the text of the image link, you know, the actual URL of the image link, just show them the image. Go out there and render the image in this application. And you see this in you know, GPotter and and Amarok and all the, even, I mean, even in like Aggregator and stuff like that for blogs, you know, a lot of people have those stupid little, I think they're called hacker gotchis or something like that, where it's just their head floating in midair, and that's like their blog symbol or whatever. So people have that, and the feed reader, rather than ignoring that or just showing the text of the image URL, will parse it and show the actual image instead in the viewer. So this is not uncommon in XML files at all, and I mean, to give an even more perhaps robust example of how XML is used, you can look at video editors. And the really good video editors will do something called exporting as an EDL, so that you, if you make a cut at 5 seconds and at 1 minute to a video clip, and then you maybe you do a dissolve or something like that, and now you need to pipe it over to some other application like Blender to do really cool special effects, it's not hard. All you have to do is export it as an EDL, and a really nice, friendly video editor, many of them aren't, but some of them are, they'll just export to pretty much plain old XML. And so as long as another application has been programmed to interpret that XML or to understand that XML, then you can actually import the XML file. And as long as you've got those same video clips on your computer or on the system with, for instance, in this case, Blender, then you can import that XML. It translates it such that it knows that rather than just telling you the times where to cut your video, it cuts the video for you, and it displays the edit decisions that someone else has made in some other application. So this is a big deal in terms of cross-compatibility between specifically video editors in this case, and it was a really big deal in Blender 2.49b, the ability to actually import XML from, for instance, Final Cut Pro was introduced. And that's a huge thing, because whether you're someone switching from Final Cut to Blender for video editing, which I don't think there are all that many people doing except me, but in that event, you can then use your old edits out of Final Cut in Blender without losing any work. Or if you are simply someone working in a multi-platform environment, which I don't think is uncommon at all, then you know, you can have the editing crew edit the video, do their basic dissolves and things like that, export that EDL, which really is just XML, and then import it into your effects package or whatever. So that's a really big deal and a really good use for XML. And similarly, it's because, I guess, the power of XML that you've got podcasts that can be used in lots of different applications. I know a lot of people used to think a lot of people still think, rather, that podcast is something specific to iTunes, that kind of lives in iTunes. You go to the iTunes store, you look for a podcast, you download it, and it's all happening within that application, so it must be magical, and it must, you know, it's got the word pod in it, so it must be related to the iPod, so it's a part of iTunes, right? That's kind of like saying the internet lives in Internet Explorer or something like that, or Firefox or Safari. Obviously it doesn't, those are just viewers. They're basically parsers, and iTunes is no exception. It parses universal XML feeds, and it presents them in a certain way. It has the little image, and it's got the links to the individual shows down at the bottom, and it's got a little description and a summary up in the main window. So, you know, you've got all these specific and sort of peculiar ways that they choose to present the information, but it's a completely universal format, which is really cool. So RSS, then, is really, yeah, it's just an implementation of XML, or rather, it is XML. It is XML. It's a name for a specific kind of XML document. The specification for exactly, like, the RSS schema and stuff like that, I don't have an exact link to or anything like that right now, but typically the easiest way is to simply go to someone with a good feed and wget their feed and just take a look at what they've got. Now, if you were to do that to my old feeds, you would see a pretty messy XML file, because it was auto-generated from different applications just as I kind of figured the whole thing out. And eventually, quite a while, it was just being carried over from very, very early, I think probably like PodPress, things like that. So they're especially messy, because those don't tend to be very clean in the way that they generate XMLs. And they can be, I'm sure, if you do the right selections, but typically you want them to be, I guess, as compatible as possible with every possible reader out there, so you start to get specific tags that only iTunes wants and stuff like that, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But if you look at my current feed, it's actually quite clean, and that was because I started from scratch, based on basically what like Larry Bushy from Going Linux kind of taught me, and from what these jobs have been teaching me in terms of what XML is. So essentially in an RSS feed, you've got the declaration that it is XML. You've got a definition of the schema that you want the reader to be aware of. And then you've got something called a channel, which is sort of saying, okay, everything in this feed is going to be branded under this specific term or under this specific channel. And then within the channel tag, you've got a bunch of item tags, which would be the individual episodes themselves. So again, I mean, the schema makes all that stuff possible, and it's a pretty much universal schema at this point, so using that is probably a good idea. And that's just the basic RSS schema, really. It's a set of tags that any reader that you give it to is going to probably understand. Again, whether or not they do things like show the image that you define in your channel, not in your item, but in your channel, that's something completely different. I mean, that's kind of like what's reading the file. What does the application choose to do? What was it programmed to do? But in terms of it actually saying, yes, this is a valid RSS feed, and receiving all the updates every time it pings that feed and things like that, and knowing where to find the media file that you want people to be able to download, or that you want the program to automatically download for them, which a lot of them do, then that's something that is going to be enabled by following the proper RSS tags. And again, if you just do a wget on the badapples.info/aug.xml or speaks.xml, spx.xml, then you will see the appropriate tags that pretty much are universal to any feed reader. Now, because it is XML, you've got a lot of power to customize it, which is what, for instance, Apple, probably the Zune marketplace at this point, has done, and probably other feed readers have, I imagine, but iTunes is the big one, and that's the one I've seen, so I'll talk about that. But iTunes, I mean, I guess they've got, like, I guess they've got the summary of the episode, but then they've also got a description of the episode or something like that, and they've got an image tag for the channel, and they've got image tags for each episode, which might be something that other feed readers add as well. I'm not really sure, but, you know, my point being that there are specific things in the iTunes interface that if those tags are present, it will make use of. Now, since there is a schema already for RSS, and you want it to work with all the non-iTunes feed readers out there, it would be silly to simply not use the RSS schema. But if you want to have the added functionality, for instance, of extra content for all those iTunes users, just as an example, then what you can do is you can actually use those iTunes tags, but you need to define the namespace. So right now, because we've already called out the RSS schema, the namespace for that document is assumed to be, okay, this is the generic RSS schema. But if you want to use something outside of that namespace, then you can simply say, okay, in this tag called description, it's iTunes specific, so it's going to be tag iTunes colon description close tag foobar 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 bracket slash iTunes colon description close bracket. So you're essentially using a tag from a different namespace, and you tell the feed reader that it is from a different namespace with that convention of name of the namespace colon and then the tag. The feed readers that don't use that information is going to ignore it, and the feed readers that can use that stuff is going to use the tag and place it wherever in the application it wants to place it or do with it what it needs to do. So if you do see a feed, for instance, out there with lots of, like, just completely normal-looking tags, and then there's a tag with iTunes colon something, or if you see the tag demarcated by a colon, that is because it is a different namespace that they're using for that particular tag. So the structure of RSS is defined by a schema, and following it fairly closely will lead to really good kind of cross-compatible, universal platform kind of functionality. So you take a look at one that you do know that seems to work, or go hunt down the schema and actually read up on it if you want. Sounds like a lot of trouble to me, though. But there are certain things that you're going to be able to have in certain portions of the document, and there are certain things that are actually required. And obviously, feed validators help a lot, and those are great, and they're a dime a dozen, so you can find them on the web. I unfortunately do not religiously use them. I really should, but I don't. But XML is fairly strict, I have found. It doesn't like tags that you forget to close, or it doesn't like misspelled tags, or tags that don't belong in the namespace that you've declared, things like that. It doesn't like that. It doesn't like when you give a date that doesn't actually exist, for instance, in an RSS feed. If you give the 29th of February 2010, doesn't exist, it can cause an error. Again, depending on the feed reader, I think you may or may not have good or bad luck. I mean, it kind of depends, and it depends on the strictness, I guess, of it. I've seen nothing but problems when I do a wrong date, for instance. That doesn't seem, no feed reader that I've seen seems to really put up with that. But other things I've gotten away with, it doesn't necessarily look pretty, and it would have been better if I'd validated it first or checked on it in a couple of different feed readers first. But just be aware of that. And this is why in an XHTML document, you can actually define whether you're using the transitional version of HTML or the strict version of XHTML, where even though, for instance, bracket B, bracket foobar, bracket slash B, close bracket, is not a part of XHTML, in transitional you can get away with using things like that, and it'll still work. And again, that's simply because you're declaring that, hey, look, we're going to do kind of a hybrid of HTML and XHTML, so don't just pop out on me if I accidentally use a bold tag in one of these files. Presumably for quite some time, web browsers everywhere will respect that kind of transitional versus strict declaration and be able to show people the content. Now, in terms of how RSS, I guess, works, I mean, I don't really know, but all that is required of an RSS feed, is to generate it at least, is a good text editor that you like that saves in text, not something like, I don't know, like OpenOffice that's going to try to save it out as an ODT file by default or something like that. But, you know, you just want it to be saved out as plain text. You do all your little tags, you know, XML, your schema, channel open, title, image, author, item open, data, close item, close channel, close RSS. So you do all that, and then you just place it somewhere on your server, on the place hosting your podcast or Augcast or whatever you're doing, blog. And from then on, when people subscribe to it, really all they're doing, as far as I understand, is setting their little feed reader on sort of, I guess you could think of it as almost a cron job. It's just like, okay, every time I open you up or every time I click on refresh feeds or something like that, I want you to ping this file that lives on this server right here. Now, if you move that XML file, it's going to break everything. So you keep the XML file on your server. People are setting their feed reader to ping that file every time they want it to, and then to see if there's any changes, and if there are any changes, to update the content in the feed reader. And that's kind of how it works, and there's not really a whole lot of mystery to it when you really kind of understand it. It's really kind of the same way as for instance, HTML. I mean, if you understand that, you understand XML more than you realize. If you have an HTML document on a server somewhere, every time someone goes to a browser and they don't have, like, crazy amounts of browser cache turned on where it, like, remembers, you know, just sees the address and then just shows them the last known copy of it, the browser essentially pings that file on the server and says, okay, looks like it's pretty much the same as last time, so I'll show the contents. So that's RSS. That's pretty much as I know about the subject. Now you pretty much know about that subject. So that is that's how RSS works, and hopefully that's a fairly accurate representation of how XML works. There's a lot more to it, and XML is really neat, and there's lots of cool ways to, like, crawl through the data and kind of parse it and stuff like that. But essentially, that's the nitty gritty parts of it. So hopefully that helps, and if you're doing an Augcast or a podcast or whatever, then I would just probably, I mean, I don't know, I prefer to generate my own RSS feeds. I think it's just easier that way. It is, it's more prone to error, that's for sure, but I think it's cleaner, and it really helps me understand it more so than trying to struggle with PodPress or some other application, iWeb, or just some other, some auto generator kind of, you know, feed burner, just whatever. A lot of times I find myself struggling with their representations of things and not really understanding what I'm trying to, you know, I know what I want to see, but I don't know which little switch they want me to flip or what value they want me to put into what blank, and so it gets really complex to me, so I try not to really to mess with that. I just do it manually. And like I say, that is prone to errors because, you know, there's typos or there, oh, I forgot to update this number in this part and whatever. You know, people start getting like the same episode both weeks. And then they emailed me and they're like, hey, the episode says 5x03, but the file I got was 5x02. What's up? So then I update the feed. But, I mean, part of that is just me because I'm not checking my work very well and I'm not validating it and all that other, and I'm not testing it before I sort of release it to the world. But I still prefer to generate the feed myself in Vim or Kate or whatever I'm happening to sit in front of at the moment. So, yeah, that's it, I think. That is RSS. Now, looks like in a little while, actually I think June 19th, which is like, I think 6 days after Southeast Linux Fest, but in June there's going to be something called FossCon, which is the, as you probably know, free open source software con, convention, and looks like I'm going to be speaking there. I'm going to be giving a talk as well as a workshop. The workshop will probably be on, like, getting to know the command line by using the command line for everyday tasks, which will be kind of like an expansion of episode, what is it, I think 4x09 from last season, where I was talking about the command line apps that I use on an everyday basis, just the stuff that I need to use on the command line to get things done. Basically in an environment where literally I don't need X, and yet I'm still as productive as ever. So and I think that kind of thing is sometimes really helpful because a lot of times if you sit in front of the command line and you're just going through this little booklet that says, here's how to list files, here's how to copy a file, here's how to move a file. I mean, yeah, those are great, and they kind of help you understand, but sometimes just seeing the power of links, --dump, foobar.html, and seeing that you just got a web page without even ever opening up a web browser at all, and in fact, not even opening up links, you just pass the command to links. It's kind of neat. So, and I think that sometimes helps you see how powerful that would be. And I guess the links dump, I would want to redirect that to a file. I forgot to mention that, but you get the idea anyway. So that will be the workshop, and then the talk will probably be on something about multimedia, probably like the workflow, multimedia workflow on Linux. That'll be cool. That'll be fun. It's in upstate New York in the Rochester Institute of Technology. So if you're in the Northeast, then check that conference out. Their site is still kind of under works. I mean, it's still pretty early in the life of the festival, I think. You know, I mean, these festivals usually don't have their sites up for registration and stuff like that so early in the year if they're going to be happening in June. But or maybe they do, I don't know. But the point is, keep an eye on it. It's FossCon.org, and sign up eventually and go. And if you see me, say hi. So that'll be cool. And I think that's, as far as I understand, it's kind of being done by, like, the Freenode people, and I think someone from the FSF is on their board or whatever. So it should be a neat festival. I'm looking forward to it. Let's see. So some listener feedback really quick. Nido, N-I-D-O, from, what is he, from Belgium or something, or Bulgaria, or maybe neither of those. But he wrote me and reminded me that I'm still sometimes releasing things in stereo for some reason. And the reason is because I keep forgetting. In Audacity, I know, like, last episode we had a little lesson on Audacity and sample rates. Well, another little tip for you that I keep forgetting myself, or I don't keep forgetting it, but I forget to do it, is that if you import a stereo track, then the whole project will export as stereo. What you need to do, if you want a mono track after you export, or as you export, you need to go into the tracks, click the track that, you know, a stereo track, click on it, and then go to, I think it's tracks, and then stereo to mono. And that squashes the two stereo channels into one mono channel, which makes a lot more sense if you're worried about file size and stuff like that, which I've, as of season 5, proclaimed that I am. It makes a lot more sense to just deliver in mono, especially since we're not really worried about the intro and outro music like we were for the first seasons. We're worried about just the voice. So I've been remembering to do that better ever since he emailed me, so it's much appreciated. And in fact, it's kind of crazy because, I mean, some of my OGG files at this point are like 8 megabytes for, you know, a full 50-minute episode, which is really, really good. And it almost makes me wonder if that Speaks version is kind of redundant at this point, because, I mean, what's the functional difference between a 3.4 megabyte Speaks file and an 8 megabyte OGG file, I mean, they're both going to download pretty fast. So I don't know if the speed is going to really last. It may, it may not. We shall see. But yes, I'm getting things really, really small, which is really, really nice. So someone from AEIO Unix, that's what it is, AEIO Unix, wrote me and said that I had a broken link on some site. It was the Kernel for Newbies site from the, I think it was the previous season. The link was fixed. It was broken. Now it's fixed. It was pointing to a .com, I think, and it was supposed to be a .org or something like that. So I fixed that and thanked the listener for the tip. This person from AIEO Unix claimed listener X. Yes, listener number X, which I thought was brilliant. I mean, a variable. I mean, I know we've had like 00, we've had various numbers, but I mean, X being a variable, that's pretty clever. And X is such a cool letter anyway, so everyone likes it. I was going to try to claim, you know, after he did that, I was going to claim like listener I, which is the mathematical symbol for an imaginary number. But I figured that was kind of cheating because I don't really, I mean, I listen to my own show, but I can't really be a listener of my own show. So he wrote back and said, how about letting Gort be listener I, which would actually be pretty accurate because I don't think Gort actually listens anyway. So he would be sort of an imaginary listener because he used to be on the show, but I banned him, of course, after I switched to Linux, and he did not, so I don't think he listens, so it's kind of appropriate. But eventually, perhaps, he'll see the light and come back to the show as a full-time, exclusive Linux user. We shall see. And with that, I don't know, I think that's about the end of the episode, to be honest. I've got more to say, but it would be a lot more, and it would probably justify another episode, so that's what I'll do. So, thanks for listening, as usual, and this has been Klaatu, and you can find me at klaatu@jabber.org if you want to IM me, or you can find me at klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org or klaatu@linuxcranks.info. If you want to email, you can find the website at thebadapples.info, and I think that's about, oh yeah, and Freenode in Linux Cranks and Slacker Media, Slackware, sometimes in FOSCON, sometimes in Southeast Linux Fest, just wherever I happen to be. My nick is not Klaatu. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.
Hacker Public Radio.